there's a lot of hate going on. You pop a cherry with an orgy and it's all good.
Really, really talented, handsome young man.
Don't walk in here with a giant banana and think everything's going to be peaches.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Tuesday, February 1st, 2011. I'm your host, Adam Berry, and joining me today, two guys who know that recruiting is all about relationships. We got Tyler Jett.
Hey, how are you doing? It's good to be back. It's a beautiful, beautiful day today.
And Greg Luca.
Glad to be back. I'm sure you guys missed somebody whispering stats to you last weekend.
We're just whispering right in their ears. That's what they like. Greg, sweet nothings are whisper stats in your ears.
That's how we get it done.
Ladies like it.
Yeah. We got a lot to talk about on today's show. We're going to talk a little bit of the football news that happened in the last week, a lot of hoop stuff, recapping the Georgia and Mississippi State games. Then we're going to do a little intro to sports journalism, talk about the basic process of putting together stories, arguably the first thing we should have discussed since it's kind of what we do. Going to go ahead and ask that now that you send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org. Before you get bored by Greg's stats in your ears, just go ahead and right now, if you have any commentary, send it to podcast@alligator.org. Let's start off with the football stuff. Probably the biggest news from the week. I guess we're not going to go chronologically here. Stan Drayton left Florida. He was a running backs coach and recruiting coordinator to be Ohio State's wide receivers coach. Certainly an interesting move. He's going to start one day before National Signing Day. Tyler, what effect do you think this has, if any?
Well, I don't know why we're even talking about this, because if you listen to the University of Florida or you read Will Muschamp's statement, you don't really care.
No, he doesn't. Stan Drayton did not exist. It had nothing to do with Stan Drayton. It was about the coaches and the players who are currently on staff.
Yeah, the statement was essentially, we've got players on this team. We've got coaches on this team. We've got high school players that we want to hopefully be on this team later.
Right.
Those are the only people we even know exist.
That to me was just kind of a big
F you,
a big middle finger, a big middle finger right at Stan Drayton. I mean, he's obviously had sort of a rocky relationship with UF in the past. He left what 3 years ago, came back last year.
He left Florida for Tennessee. This was before the Lane Kiffin deal. This is during the Philip Fulmer era. And then left Tennessee after a year and went to Syracuse and then came back this season to Florida and like everything was mended. It didn't seem like this was a big personal thing. Like I think last time there was something personal. Like he, I think afterwards, said something about Meyer, if you remember that.
Yeah, that's right. I don't remember exactly what was said.
Right, so I think there was a personal reason why he left last time. I don't think that was the case this time. He said back in the 2006 National Championship or in the weeks leading up to it that he was a huge Ohio State fan. He had grown up in Ohio, basically said, how can you not be an Ohio State fan being from there? Everything is all about Ohio State. So I think that played a part in this. Also, this is a new coach. This wasn't his guy. Like, Muschamp wasn't the guy he came to coach for. On a personal level, I did like Stan. I like talking to him. So that's cool. He was always pretty nice to the media. So was Terrell Austin. So two guys that we really liked in the media are both out.
I was going to say he was one of the three coaches retained by Muschamp, but certainly wasn't really a Muschamp guy. I think that was more or less a move of your recruiting coordinator. He seems to have his stuff together as far as that goes. Hold on to him and maybe hope that has a little bit of a domino effect going into the recruiting class. Because everything Muschamp did, and I said this on a previous podcast, seemed to be very heavily geared toward recruiting, just as far as the guys he brought in and everything like that. So I think that was. Pretty much the motivation behind that move.
Right. I mean, recruiting is obviously the most important aspect of a college football team. How well you recruit generally speaks to how well your team's going to be. As far as this class is concerned, Drayton brought in two kids, Michael Blakely and Javaris McCoy,
McRoy.
They are both already on campus at UF, so that's not really going to affect them. He was kind of in the running for a defensive tackle down in Booker T. Washington High in Miami. But other than that, he wasn't really in the – everyone else that he was recruiting was already committed firmly to other schools. So I don't think this is really going to hurt them directly in this recruiting class. And I think that this – honestly, I don't think it's going to be a huge deal for Florida.
Okay. I mean, you don't think it affects recruiting just at all? Like a couple weeks before signing day, you lose, quote-unquote, your recruiting coordinator. I don't know – honestly, and I'll be completely upfront about this. I don't know what the job recruiting coordinator completely entails.
I'm pretty sure basically you're in charge of recruiting and that you assign different coaches to different areas.
Okay.
So you kind of – you're essentially the think tank, or you're the one-man think tank behind the whole recruiting process. What would be interesting would be Jawan Story, the receiver from Nature Coast High. I just mixed up two cities and blended into one. Nature Coast High receiver. He visited Ohio State, I want to say, not this weekend, but the weekend before, so 2 weekends ago. And he's a receiver, obviously. And Stan Drayton, who was coaching at Florida, and I'm sure their paths have crossed at some point during his visits to Florida.
Right.
So they know each other, and now that's going to be his position coach at Ohio State if you were to switch his commitment. He's orally committed to Florida. rumors out there that he loved Oregon, but I don't think Oregon ever offered him. So
yeah, he was really high on Oregon. He was trying to earn that Nike scholarship, you know?
Right. As I learned on the TV show Oz about prison, love is when two people care about each other, but only one person does. It's called infatuation. So he had an infatuation with Oregon.
That's fair. Any further impact you see on this is, as far as the running backs go next year? Obviously, they're probably going to try to bring in more of a pro-style guy, whatever.
Right.
You know,
they want a pro-style runner. Right. Spread option runners.
Right. Most likely, it's probably going to be a Weiss guy, you know.
Right. The running backs really didn't do that good this year, and he's the running backs coach. When Jeff Dimps got hurt, that was obviously a big blow to them. But after that game, I asked him a couple days after, who's in charge of rotating players? Because Dimps got like 26 carries that game and then ended up getting hurt and was done. And Drayton said, that's on me. This is before they realized how big of an injury it was. But he said, I probably should have rotated guys more. And I knew Dimps has a chance to explode. Like, I figure he's good for one big run a game and he hadn't had it yet. So
just
I figured,
waiting for it.
Just wait for it. And I think Jeff Dimps, in the 2 weeks before that Tennessee game, had big runs against Miami, Ohio, and South Florida, both of which had sparked the team, like a 70-yard run, like a 63-yard run. And after those touchdowns, Florida's offense got a lot better, and I think that's kind of what he was hoping to see and never really happened. So I think he was partially to blame for Jeff Dimps getting hurt, and then after that, none of the other running backs really could step up. Rainey obviously missed a good part of the season for Buck Wild texting, and really, the most confusing thing was Emmanuel Moody this season, his senior year, because him and Drayton had a great relationship, supposedly. And, like, Drayton was the big reason why Emmanuel Moody had transferred from USC, I want to say, 4 years ago, three years ago, or whatever it was.
Decades ago at this point, it feels like.
Yeah. And in the life of a college student, it was about 10 years ago. But, yeah, so everyone kind of expected, you know, Moody would have a big season, especially with Tim Tebow gone. You need a power runner. Moody's big. Him and Drayton had a good relationship, and he pretty much just disappeared this year. So something weird happened there. And, really, I mean, look at it. I think running backs average like 130-something yards rushing per game, like all the running backs together under Drayton. The year before, under Kenny Carter, they averaged like 157 yards per game or something like that. So the running backs actually didn't do as much even without a running quarterback, which is something we didn't expect coming into it. I like Stan Drayton, but the running backs weren't very productive this year under him. So I don't think this is going to be like a huge blow for Florida.
Right. And I mean, certainly, you know, they're looking at a personnel shift as far as systems and schemes go, and looking for a more pro style runner that could be more of an every down back, maybe a little focused away perhaps from the Dempsey and Randy types. You could see more of that Mike Gillisley and, you know, stuff like that going forward. I don't know if that would affect that, the running back coach would affect that, or
I don't know.
Be purely a Weiss thing.
I really don't know what to expect out of the running backs going into next year. I'm not really sure. Yeah, like I said, the running backs didn't perform well. It's not like anyone really showed anything that you would say, like, wow, Gillisley really can be a great runner. Like, at times, he looked like a pretty strong runner, but, like, at the end of the day, you look at his stats, and they weren't that impressive. So I don't know where they go. Also, I don't necessarily know, like, if there's such thing as, like, a pro-style running backs coach versus a spread-option running backs coach, because, I mean, Drayton was working at Tennessee under Philip Fulmer. That was not a spread-option offense. That was a quote-unquote pro-style offense. So it's not like he... It's not like they're going to be getting someone that has a ton of experience in an area that fits them better.
Huh, that's a good point. All right, let's move on then to a little other news, a little more fun news from last
week.
You
black-hearted individuals.
That's me. I always end on the bad. Right. I always end on the bad note. We're going to talk about the bad news. Bad news, Gators fans, as we're fond of saying around here. Janoris Jenkins arrested, I believe it was late Friday night, early Saturday morning, in a nightclub where all bad things happen for athletes. Rolling, I believe the language was, a cannabis cigarette in that nightclub bathroom. It was less than 20 grams of marijuana, so he was not arrested. He was charged and cited with possession. But this is the first legal trouble under Muschamp. It'll be interesting to see how he reacts to that. And, I mean, yeah, that was kind of an interesting story from last week.
Yeah, it's good to see Muschamp getting on the board with his first arrest as a Gators coach. Really, that's how you really get into this job. So you got to be able to deal with this. This is what it's all about, man.
What was the thing he said in the introductory press conference? The Florida way? Was it the Florida way or the Gator way?
I think it was
the Florida way.
It was the Florida, Florida way.
This is the Florida way.
Right. This is the Florida way that he's instilling right now. Like, we joke about it and we say it's the first arrest under Muschamp. This obviously has nothing on Muschamp, I don't think. Janoris is just, you know, Janoris is doing what Janoris is going to do.
Janoris came back for a senior season. He's going to be enjoying it, man.
Right. But yeah, I mean, what do you, out of curiosity, just what do you think is the reaction here? Do you think Janoris, quote-unquote, isn't ready to play come the first game of the season? Do you think he sits out spring practice?
I don't think it's a big enough. This isn't Frankie Hammond getting a DUI. This is not, he didn't put anyone else in danger. I'm pretty sure that, like, any football coach, anybody who isn't naive knows that a lot of members of the football team probably smoke weed, just like a lot of people on college campus smoke weed.
Wait, what?
Sorry, Greg. Earmuffs, Greg. We'll tell you when we'll tell you when you can listen again. People, I mean, they do. This is just a it's a misdemeanor. It wasn't a huge deal. Right. I think he'll probably end up having to run extra laps or run sprints or something like that. Like they'll handle this internally, but this isn't something that should be a big deal. I think sometimes we get so fed up with, like, we count the number, 30 players arrested under Meyer or whatever it was. It was a pretty large number.
Right.
And but sometimes we look at it and we kind of lump them all together, but some of them are just dumb ones. Like, was it Cornelia? Who was it?
The sandwich thrower?
Yes.
That was
Jermaine Cunningham?
That was Cunningham.
Yeah, Jermaine Cunningham, who got a misdemeanor for throwing a sandwich at Jimmy John's. Yeah. So, I mean, there's things like that that just aren't that huge of a deal. Like, this is obviously illegal. Weed is not legal to smoke in Florida. Sorry if I break off that knowledge.
Breaking news.
But I guess my point is that it's not a huge deal. Like, this isn't going to be something that's going to really affect Norris's playing time.
Right.
Plus, he's a damn fine cornerback.
Right, he's a really good cornerback. Like, you can't mess around with that. But I agree. I think we sometimes, especially in the media, we get so, and the fans too as well, get so jaded of like, oh, another Gators arrest. It's like, they're not actually really connected, you know? Like, these guys aren't out, you know.
It's not all a gang that are just all right, you're going to fire your AK-47. I'm going to smoke my weed, Jermaine. He's
on the sandwiches, you know? Like, there's none of that. They're not rolling through town together causing trouble.
They don't have a scheme.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, this is all isolated stuff. I don't even remember when the last... Was Frankie Hammond the last arrest?
No. Well, that would be a little man we like to call Chris Rainey, who did a little thing called threatened to kill someone.
Buck while texting, yeah. All right, but, I mean, those are three very separated... I'm not standing up for Janoris in any way. I'm not, you know... More power to him, whatever, but these aren't connected, and I think the reaction has been a little over the top as far as trying to link them all together and then linking them to Muschamp. So calm down, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. Last bit of football news. We're going to go hard on this next week, recapping National Signing Day, but let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff coming up for the Gators. You mentioned Juwan's story. That'll probably be one of the big focal points come Wednesday for Gators fans out there. Another one is Tim Jernigan, defensive tackle up in Lake City. Anything else you think the Gators need to do out of this signing class?
I think a real important part, obviously, is that they have salvaged the class for the most part. They only lost a couple of kids. And I think with this being the first signing class, there shouldn't be much pressure on Muschamp. And also, I would say there shouldn't be pressure to just start just getting people to get numbers. You know what I mean? Like, don't sit there and be like, all right, we got 17 kids in this class. We need to get 25. We can get 25. We got to go find 8 more kids and just start reaching for kids who probably aren't good enough to play. So I think if you've only got 17 guys who are good enough to play at the University of Florida that you've already got and you can't get anybody else, you can't convince anybody at the last minute, what with Meyer leaving and all of that, then whatever, just deal with that. Just to say, okay, we'll only take 17 in this class and the next class is really our best shot. I think the real test of how good Muschamp as a recruiter we'll find in the 2012 class, not the 2011 class. As far as guys that are really on the board that could be big acquisitions for them, the two Dwyer kids first. Would be defensive, or actually, that's outside linebacker Kurt Majette. That's where Rivals has him listed. I think he played a lot of defensive end as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then quarterback Jacoby Brissett, who they offered a scholarship to, or I guess Charlie Weiss's first year on the job, went down to Dwyer and talked to him, really liked him, liked his film, came back up, talked to Muschamp, as the story goes, and then they basically called and offered him a scholarship. Supposedly in like November, I guess, Urban went down there to recruit him, but insulted him by offering him a gray shirt, which for those that don't know, basically means like you're in the class, but you can't come up to campus for like a year.
Right.
Like it's essentially like a red shirt, just worse. Red shirt players, you still get to practice with the team, you still get to work out everything. Gray shirt players, it's like you're just gonna wait at home for about a year.
I was gonna say, they send them prep schools and stuff sometimes.
Well, prep school is more like if you don't qualify. Gray shirt is like you just
chill,
just go home, just watch, play a lot of Madden, and. When it's your time, you'll come. So I think he was obviously insulted by that because he had some offers from like some pretty good schools. Like he's going to South Carolina on visits. I mean, he's got a lot of other schools that are legitimate Division I programs. I wanted in Florida, didn't really care, but now they do. And all of a sudden, is it enough? Is it too late? I know he is best friends with Matt Elam, strong safety, Florida. Florida landed 3 Dwyer kids in last year's class, which I think could be big translating to this year's class.
That's true. Yeah, I'm not sure how that whole situation plays out. There's the Dwyer kids are going to be big, and then the two guys I mentioned before, Story and Jernigan. But Florida recently picked up another commitment. Greg, you got the information here?
Yep, they recently landed Graham Stewart from Xavier High School in Middletown, Connecticut. Shout out to Connecticut. And
he's from Connecticut.
Yeah.
So he's
shout out to Connecticut.
He's rated as the 16th best middle linebacker in the class of 2011. And he was originally committed to BC. Then he had a visit from Muschamp, and apparently Muschamp just rocked his world and changed his mind around.
He's like Justin Timberlake.
Right. This is actually interesting because I didn't know anything about the kid, and I'll admit I don't follow recruiting as closely as I did. But Tom Green, our recruiting writer, also didn't know a whole lot about this kid. And Tom is real hard on the recruiting stuff. He follows it very deeply, and even he was like, "Huh." Like, apparently they got a kid, and I don't know anything about him. So kind of a deep cut, if you will, of getting this kid. But he's a 4-star, one of the top 16 middle linebackers in the 16th. Country.
He's one of the top 16 middle linebackers.
Yeah.
You figure out where he was ranked in that period, but he's one of the top 16.
That was PR speak on my part. Wow. Yeah, he's the 16th best middle linebacker in the country according to Rivals. I mean, literally, we don't know anything about the kid. So
Florida has a little pipeline in Connecticut, oddly enough. Like, it doesn't make any sense that Florida would be good at getting kids in Connecticut, but that's where Aaron Hernandez is from.
That's right.
That's where Jordan Reed is from there. Right. Tyler Murphy.
Me.
Greg Luca.
The Alligator also has a recruiting pipeline in Connecticut.
So there we go.
What kind of young riders have we got in that area that we can maybe push for next year?
I'll talk to some people. We'll figure some things out.
Okay. Any promising prospects? What? You got a brother here?
No, unfortunately.
You got a brother that's sitting there just crunching stats right now.
Like I said, we'll see what we can do.
All right, we'll make some in-home visits to see what we can do. But yeah, that's all we really got for National Signing Day right now. Tune back next week. We will go real hard on some National Signing Day coverage.
I think we should do this year is we'll give you, in the podcast information, we'll give you a list of from minute 4 to 7, we'll be looking at this person's highlight tape, and that way you can watch along with us and hear us go, oh!
We did that, actually.
Yeah, last year, but y'all didn't give a list of what YouTube videos you guys were watching.
Yeah, this was
if you're listening to it, you're just you hear people go, oh! it's really
uncomfortable, yeah.
You thought you were watching a group of guys just watch porn together, so...
Pretty much. I think we were actually watching the Tebow Nice game because Mike was in the office and we had one of the monitors set up. We were just watching a Tebow Nice game and apparently grunting by the sound of it. I tried to block that one out.
It was very odd.
All right, let's talk a little Florida basketball. Greg, you want to give us a recap and a rundown of what happened last week in the unpredictable, wacky world of Gators basketball?
Yep. Let's see. Tuesday, got a win in double overtime against Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Big story there was Irving Walker's long three-pointer at the end of overtime to send the game to a second overtime.
Ballsy,
I believe. Ballsy three, according to him. You just have to keep your cool, step up and be ballsy. And so that helped them get the win in double overtime. They dominated there. Parsons really took over in the second overtime period. And then,
that's when he always shines.
Right. Yeah.
The second overtime.
He's just waiting.
And then that win brought us up to Saturday?
Correct.
Saturday.
You were there, yeah.
Right. Saturday against Mississippi State in Starkville, where really free throw shooting was the story of that game. The Gators went just 9-19 from the line, missed a couple of key ones down the stretch, and then that left the door open for Mississippi State to get the 7-point win. All those last 7 points were from the line for Mississippi State after it was a tie game at 64 with about 3 minutes left.
Would Florida shoot 9-19?
9 of 19, yeah.
This has been a season-long problem for them. What's the percentage you had on the year?
They are at 65.3% on the year.
Woof.
Which is, I think it was in the 270s nationally.
How about
good.
That?
Wow.
Not good.
I mean, what's your take on where the team is at right now? They put together a pretty, 3 wins in 6 days, which was really impressive. Grinded out the win at Auburn, came home and just ran all over Arkansas, and then, pulled out a pretty tight one in Georgia. They kind of ran the gamut of everything. They didn't shoot well at Auburn. They did everything well against Arkansas, and then... everything didn't necessarily go their way, but they had. They shot free throws pretty well at Georgia. All those things kind of combined. What's your take right now?
Honestly, it's like everybody's been saying all season. This team is just impossible to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like Patrick Young said today, sometimes they just don't play well. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they can't get focused and up for a game, and sometimes they can. So.
That was the best assessment of the Florida Gators basketball team. And what's great about it is if you followed up with the question why, you wouldn't get an actual answer.
No.
Because there is not a known answer. They can't if they knew why, they would be able to solve it.
Exactly.
They can't figure out why they can't come and play well every week.
Right. This is something I tried to write about a couple weeks ago, is that there's no one fixable issue on this team. You don't fix Florida's free throw shooting and all of a sudden, they're 12-4 in the conference. Florida's not going to be a great outside shooting team. They're going to defend well some nights, they're not going to defend well the other nights. You can't predict them. They either come out ready to play or they don't. And like Tyler said, you ask them why, they don't know.
Yeah, it's every season. It seems like if they get on a couple game winning streak, then they might come out flat one game.
Yep.
Then once they lose, it's like it reignites them, and then they play well for a week or so, and then maybe they repeat the process again.
That's what was impressive to me, I'll admit, about the Georgia game, is that they came off of a very impressive win at home, went on the road against a pretty good team, in a pretty tough crowd from what you said, and they actually didn't let down. And even if they did let down at first and, you know, they lost some momentum, they managed to pick themselves back up. And that's not something this team has done well recently.
Right. Yeah. I kind of look at Florida – sorry, I'm going to interject real quick. I kind of look at them as if, like, they're going to have a really good game and they're going to have a bad game. It's like a cycle almost. Mm-hmm. So I felt like Georgia was kind of their bad game, but they fought through it and won, which I thought was a huge testament to them.
It's the same thing about Auburn, though. That was a bad game, except it's just against a terrible team.
Well, that was a bad game. They came back and played a great game, right. And they played another bad game. So the Mississippi State game, I figured they were due for another good game. Right. I was in the kitchen on Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon, and my roommate was like, you watching the Florida-Mississippi State game? I said, I'll watch a little bit of it, but they're probably going to blow them out just because they're due for a great game. He goes, well, they're actually down by 10 right now. I said, oh, crap. So then I went and turned it on. Like, oh, it's 25-15. They didn't show up. But, I mean, I thought they kind of went on a run in the second half. They're like, okay, they're going to recover, and this is going to be a W. And then they ended up folding down the stretch because, you know, those free throws when you have no defense on you is kind of tough.
Right, yeah. Mississippi State came out and shot the ball really well to start the game, and that's how they got the early lead. But Florida really started pounding it inside and settled down that way. And then they went into half just down a point or two, but... At that point, when I asked Irvin Walker about it after the game, and he said they were really confident at that point because they had survived the early storm, and they're the better team. They right. knew that. Everybody knows that. It just seemed like if they made it through that part of the game that they would be able to come through and get the win, but it didn't work out that way.
Right. The second half run Tyler's talking about was, oddly enough, a large product of the bench. It was – who was it? It was Walker. Who was on the floor at that point? Walker, Wilbekin?
I think it was just Walker and then – Walker, Wilbekin, Prather,
Yeget,
and Murphy.
And Murphy, which was a really weird lineup.
Yeah.
Billy Donovan, all stars.
Yeah, that really was an interesting, unusual lineup. But what was the run? 13-1?
13-1, I think.
Is that when they were pressing?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's what that is, sort of, with Yeget and Prather and
the
Wilbekin.
Press lineup.
That's an energy lineup, yeah. I mean, Murphy doesn't necessarily, other than the fact that exciting things always happen when Eric Murphy's on the floor, that was kind of an odd move there. I think Patrick Young is the guy who fits in that spot because he's
athletic.
Really athletic, and I feel like he's more likely to defend a little tougher. But
and Patrick Young is a strong enough guy that he could handle Sydney, who is 300 pounds, like he said. So
he's just a Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, like, as far as I could tell. What a big man!
Murphy and Macklin just couldn't do anything about how big he was.
And God help you if you put Tyus on him. Like,
yeah,
to defend.
That's not even funny.
But I mean, it was actually D. Boss who sort of took over the game at the end there.
Yeah,
great name.
Well, yeah. According to Greg, what was the sign?
D-Boss is D-Best. Yeah. So
I would agree with that. It's such a fun sign, such a fun name.
Yeah, over the last 12 minutes, he actually outscored Florida's team 12-9. So
wow.
That was, D-Boss. Aside from the fact that Florida should have a lot more than 9 points in 12 minutes, D-Boss took over and outscored the Gators.
We've talked about this before, though, where Florida just doesn't score at the end of games. I'm curious because I spent the whole year covering the team doing that. You've now spent a good enough time seeing that happen. Can you come up with any reason for it, other than poor free throw shooting?
I really can't. It seems like the stretches where they don't score well are pretty unpredictable in themselves. Just when it's going to happen is anybody's guess, but you know it will at some
right.
point.
We should ask Patrick Young about that. Why does that happen? I don't know. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
The answer would be, sometimes we know we put the ball in the hoop, sometimes we don't put the ball in the hoop.
That's
and when we don't put the ball in the hoop, we don't score as many points.
That might actually have been word for word a Billy Donovan quote at some point. Billy Donovan explained to us the concept of what happens when the ball goes into the hoop and whatnot. He also explained to us...
He's a great teacher of fundamentals.
He is. Everybody has a personality.
Everybody has a personality. And if every starter scores 15, they'll have a lot of points.
Yeah.
16.
16.
Yeah, you want every starter to score 16 and be good.
Right. Yeah, that would certainly help.
That would be kind of nice.
But I guess let's talk a little bit about this week coming up. I think this, and I'm going to write about this coming up a couple days here, I think this is a huge week for Florida. They got Vanderbilt at home on Tuesday night when this podcast is going up at 9 p.m. on ESPN. They got Kentucky at 9 p.m. on ESPN Saturday. College game day's in town. This is a huge week for them. They went 0-4 against these two teams last year. They've always talked about you have to beat the best to be the best. And I think if they beat these two teams, at least here at home, they can sort of establish themselves as a front runner in the SEC East, which to me right now is very muddled.
Yeah, I agree this is a really important week for them because you play Vanderbilt and Kentucky at home. Over the last 9 games they have remaining all in the SEC, they play Vanderbilt twice, they play Kentucky twice, they play Tennessee, they play Georgia, they play Alabama, and they play South Carolina again. Those are the better teams in the SEC where they played a lot of the West teams already and a lot of the weaker East teams already.
Which is to say the worst teams.
Yeah, basically. So, especially with having to play Vanderbilt and Kentucky twice, it would be important for them to hold serve at home, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And then when they go on the road, then at least you have the game that you won at home in hand already.
Right. And what's Florida's SEC record right now? 5-2?
Yeah, 5-2.
Let's go. We'll go through game by game those the things that have left, because Florida has not won more than 9 games in the SEC since the 04s were here. They won 9 games last year, 9 the year before, and 8. They went 8-8 the first post 04 year. Mm-hmm. So what's they're 5-2. Run through each game. We'll volley me and Tyler. Will what they can win.
All right. Well, Vanderbilt home.
That's
due for a win, man.
They're due for a win. That's right. I'm gonna say they got the win there.
Kentucky home?
Nah,
absolutely not.
Kentucky's too challenging.
I think they get swept by Kentucky this year.
South Carolina on the road.
God, they're due to drop that game, I think.
I think they'll lose that one.
South Carolina came in here and won.
Right. That's why I think they're going to lose.
Maybe there's a revenge thing?
They lost. I believe they lost last year on the road to South Carolina.
It's not about revenge. It's about, you know, we're going to wake up and play good one day, or we're going to wake up and not play good. So
they're so focused on the road when they can sleep in a hotel and not party.
They are, honestly. Like, and that was the – I think we talked about that last week on the podcast, where Billy put him in a hotel for the Arkansas game, and it worked out.
And then next is Tennessee at home.
I think they win that, actually.
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, they beat Tennessee on the road. I don't necessarily think Tennessee's as good of a team as other people might think they are. So I was looking at someone, I think Jimmy Dykes, the great Jimmy Dykes, had them as a Sweet 16 team, and I would say that they're not nearly that good.
Didn't last year's Tennessee team make the Sweet 16? Arguably the worst Tennessee team, which is outrageous.
Well, that's the thing. It's like when you make these predictions like in February of who's going to make the Sweet 16, you're essentially saying they're going to get a good seed, they're going to get a favorable setting, right. Maybe a team that they're supposed to play gets upset.
Right.
This is just going to happen.
Which nobody knows.
Right.
Tennessee is also wildly inconsistent, so...
That'd be great.
Well, Bruce probably back by that point, guess. Or no?
Yeah, yes.
Ooh,
yeah, that's a little bit tough. Sweaty Bruce.
I'm excited about Sweaty Bruce coming back. I'm not saying ooh is in like that could be tough for them. I meant like it's just fun to watch him, and I need something to watch. Him and Brian Williams are both very fun to watch.
I agree. That's a home game though, right?
Yes.
That Florida always gets pretty keyed up for Tennessee at home. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
the rowdy reptiles get extra rowdy.
After Tennessee, it's at LSU.
Yeah, that's a win.
It's a win. Then Georgia at home.
Can they beat Georgia twice? Really?
I think they can.
All right, you talked me into it.
That's easy enough.
When I bring up a bunch of stats like that, I know that you're...
Yeah, they
it's
can.
It's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, they can. Good point, Tyler.
Kentucky on the road, I guess you're just going to put that as a loss right now.
Nah, dog, nah.
Home against Alabama. That's an interesting one.
Ooh. Alabama is...
Alabama's the best of the West right now.
They're playing crappy West teams twice this season, but I mean, what's their record? They have the best record in the SEC right now, right?
They are, I believe, 5-1 in conference. Yeah, 5-1.
There you go. Who'd they beat?
They beat Mississippi State.
Okay.
Away. They won South Carolina at home. They beat Kentucky at home.
So they're beating all the teams that Florida loses to.
Yeah, I think Bama could win that game.
Their loss was on the road at Arkansas. So,
I mean, the Bama came really close last year to beating Florida, and granted, this was the Dan Werner era, so like it was a little bit of a darker time. But they came close to beating Florida at home and at Alabama last year. And I think Anthony Grant coaches the team well. They could pull out a win there.
And
that's like a Florida
drop. You convinced me, Adam.
Good. We go back and forth here.
And then the last game of the SEC season is away at Vanderbilt.
I'm going to say they lose that.
Yeah.
Did you give them the win, Vanderbilt, at home?
No.
I mean, it's fair to
call. No, yeah, we said they're going to win on Tuesday.
We said they're going to win Tuesday but lose at Vanderbilt. Okay. That seems right to me. Split Vanderbilt, get swept by Kentucky.
Yeah,
sweep Tennessee. That seems to me about where Florida is.
Sure.
If they go 3-3 in those 6 games, that would be about right.
Right.
So, I thought what really surprised me was looking at the notes today, the media notes for the game coming up, is I thought that Vanderbilt was much better in the SEC than they were under Kevin Stallings. They're under 500 in the SEC. Like they're like what? I don't know what it is, but it's like yeah, they're not doing that good.
Really.
For his career, which really surprised me. I thought Vanderbilt's always been in Florida's head,
right.
at least he almost got in a fight with Joe Kim Noah once, which I have a lot of respect for any coach that's going to get a fight with a college student.
I feel like since A.J. Ogilvie's been there, like Vanderbilt just doesn't lose to Florida, except for the one I remember this game, actually, I went to it with Mike DeFernando when Chandler Parsons just dropped 27 points.
When he just was hot.
2 years ago, yeah. And just, you know, he went up there, nobody expected, and he just dropped a ton of points. But otherwise, that was after he missed the free throw that they passed full court. Devin Downey got the game winning layup.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So this is back in 2008 when South Carolina stole one from them. Chandler missed the free throw. Then the next game, Chandler just came out hot as a pistol.
He did. I remember the lead from that story. It was a long night for Chandler Parsons turned into a very long afternoon for the Vanderbilt Commodores.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't my lead, don't worry.
You're welcome, listeners.
but our little projections there, our unofficial, very professional analysis there, has Florida at 10-6 in the SEC, which I think is where
they've broken their ceiling.
Yeah, which
sounds
is where
right.
they should be. which is also, though, if we say they're 10-6, this team can lose games whenever. They could finish 9-7. They could finish 11. You know, they could finish 11-5. I think that's that same range that they've been capable of the last couple years. That's where they're at again. So,
and the way this year started out, 10-6 could easily be enough to win the SEC.
Do you think so?
Every team has 3 losses so far, except for Florida and Alabama, I want to say.
Kentucky lost to?
I can double check that.
Because we've got Kentucky sweeping.
Kentucky's a confusing team. I just feel like Kentucky's going to beat them no matter what.
Right.
Kentucky lost to Georgia and Alabama, so they only have 2. That's my mistake.
And those are good losses.
Yeah, both away.
Maybe. We don't
both
know.
Both away. Right. Yeah, they might be good losses. They seem like good losses at this point. But, yeah, I think those are huge games. Vanderbilt is very good across the board. No real huge one star, but a lot of talented players. They got a really strong front court, a couple of good shooters. What's got Jenkins?
John Jenkins, Jeffrey Taylor is another guy.
Jeffrey Taylor.
And then inside, Festus Ezeli was a guy that was talked about a lot at media today,
mm-hmm.
just about how much he's developed and how he's a scorer and a rebounder now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have Lance Goldborn?
Goldborn, yeah.
Goldborn, who and is then, leading the SEC in rebounds in conference play.
Random, yeah.
Yeah.
So. About that.
And then my boy Changang, right? He's still kicking around?
Changang, yeah.
What's his name?
Changang, spelled with a T-C-H-I-E, right?
Okay, is that all? Is that his full name or is his first
name?
That's
his last name.
His last name's Changang? What's his first name?
Steve.
Of course it is. Why wouldn't it be Steve?
Steve Changang.
Yeah.
Steve Changang.
Of course. But yeah, that's going to be a close one. Kentucky's, like you said, it's a very weird team, loaded with athletes. I mean, Brandon Knight, Terrence Jones, it's a very good team. I think they come in, they do what they did to Florida last year. They come in and they just out-athlete them.
I'd just love to see Alex Tyus trying to guard Terrence Jones.
Oh, it's going
to
be so much
fun. I'm looking forward to that already.
We really ran Tyus up the flagpole last week as far as Kyle and I just tarring and feathering him, as Jesse said. But it's like Greg and I, we were talking about this before the show. Alex Tyus is a miserable one-on-one defender.
If anybody watched the Mississippi State game and the job he tried to do against Cody Augustus, it was pathetic, honestly. Yeah. Like, it was just poor effort
right. All
the way around.
All right, so we'd say that Alex Tyus is not the best player on this team, but an interesting discussion that Greg came up with for this show is, who do we think right now is the best player on the Florida men's basketball team?
And the way we're going to do this is we're all going to name our player, and then Greg will read us that person's stats, and then we will pretend like we know what we're talking about.
Correct, as usual.
Okay, I'll go first.
Yeah,
I'll be the first one in the water. It's pretty cold. Vernon Macklin is who I'm going to go with.
All right, Vernon Macklin, 11.3 points per game, 6.3 rebounds, leading the team at 58% shooting. That's about all I got.
How many minutes does he play a game?
He is at 23.5.
Right. I'm talking about when he's on the floor, he's the best player on the team. The thing is, obviously, he's got these injuries that he's playing through.
Mm-hmm.
But they need a post presence. And he's a good player in the post. What's his 58%
field goal percentage? That's all you can ask for.
Yeah, you can't do much more than that. Honestly, would you argue with me that if he was healthy enough to play 30-something minutes a game that...
I don't even think he needs to play 30 minutes a game. If he can play 26, 28, and he can be relied on late in games to play, you know, consistent minutes. I don't know if that's a free throw shooting thing, but I know that at times he's been yanked around.
Diamond has admitted that sometimes they have to pull Vernon Macklin late in games because he's only a 40% free throw shooter this season, and teams will foul him in a situation where Florida's up by 4 or 5 and the team needs to save time and get the ball back.
Right. All right, if you did like a blind resume thing and you did 40%, 58%. What's the player's free throw shooting? What's field goal percentage? Right. Who would think 58% would be his field goal percentage?
I completely agree. But he can't.
He's just shooting hook shots from the free throw line.
We were all just ready to make that same joke. I agree. Yeah, but the hook shot, and this is why I sort of agree with you. The hook shot is arguably Florida's best offensive weapon, as far as establishing Vernon Macklin early. When they do that, that's probably as good as they get.
Right. I don't think anything is harder to defend that Florida does offensively than getting Vernon the ball one-on-one, let him do a hook shot.
I agree.
Like, you can give Kenny Boynton wide-open threes all day, and he'll make 1 out of 3 of those. You give Vernon Macklin the ball in the post one-on-one, he'll probably make 3 out of 3 of those on the hook. So for those of you counting at home, that's 6 points in 3 possessions from Vernon Macklin and 3 points in 3 possessions from Kenny Boynton.
I mean, Macklin is important because if you can get it inside to him and he can do the hook shot, teams have to try to play help defense on him. That opens other things up. But at the same time, if you take away the hook shot, there's really not much else he has.
Well, how do you take away a hook shot? I guess you go double. You have to double him, but then you double him, you free everyone else up.
And he's a pretty good passer from the post. I've always been fairly impressed by his ability to do that. The problem is when you're passing to guys like Kenny Boynton, who hit, you know, 1 of
3.
9 open threes, you know.
Yeah.
And then
7 of 7 open threes after that.
Exactly. So, like, you never really know what you're going to get from that. But I agree. Like, Macklin is extremely important to this team. I don't know if he's the best just because I don't know what all he adds. What's his rebounding numbers?
6.3. You would expect more.
Where does that fall on the team?
That is second.
Who's first?
Chandler. Parsons with 7.3.
Yeah. I don't know, I expect a little more, and this could be a product of his minutes or whatever, but I expect some more energy stuff. What's Macklin's blocks?
21. They don't break it down per game. That would be it's
what's
one, though.
What's Patrick Young?
Patrick Young.
And then Alex Tyus.
Patrick Young has 17. Alex Tyus has 18.
Huh.
Right, how many minutes, though?
That didn't go nearly the way I thought it did.
Don't you love it when your arguments just fall apart on you?
Young plays 17 minutes a game.
Okay.
So it's not that much different.
Right, it's not a huge difference. But to me, Macklin's a guy who...
23-17, significant.
6 minutes per game, yeah. I mean, Macklin should be getting more blocks. He should be rebounding more, you know, defending a little better. I feel like he should be a little more reliable in that way.
He just doesn't seem that physical.
I agree. I'll give you this. He's a lot more physical than he was last year. And I think he's a lot more valuable to this team now than he was. I might put him second, as a matter of fact.
All right, well, then who do you have first, Adam Berry?
Good question, Tyler. I'm going to go with, no surprise whatsoever, I apologize, Chandler Parsons. I think Billy talked about this today in response to a question that Tyler asked about Kenny Boynton. A really good question, got a really good answer. Just like Kenny is hard to predict, you know, as far as the shooting goes, what do you need Kenny to do? And he essentially said he needs to be doing what Chandler does, which is contribute in every other way. Because that's... And, you know, we've said, whatever, Chandler goes into the witness protection program as soon as he misses one shot and all that stuff. And that's true, but he's still leading the team in rebounds. He's still on the floor. He is a good passer, which is dangerously approaching Dan Werner territory with this kind of description.
But he's doing the little things.
He is doing the little things. This is the difference, though, between Dan Werner and Chandler Parsons. Dan Werner supposedly does the little things that don't show up in the box scores. Chandler Parsons actually does the little things that do show up in the box scores. I think
so he's less magical.
Exactly. Which is, you know, downgrade. But I think he's the most important in terms of getting him involved, you know, is important to the team's success on the boards, on offense, everything.
Getting him involved in the boards?
It was like, well,
game plan him to get a lot of rebounds.
That was a, yeah.
Jeez, Adam.
I know. That was actually a reference to a question that happened in media, but that was an inside joke.
That all the listeners would get. Yeah, right. It's great to go with inside jokes on a podcast.
Exactly. But yeah, I think Chandler's important as far as getting himself established.
I'll give you the guys the numbers from Chandler Parsons and make a couple points off of that.
I was wondering about, what are the numbers from Chandler Parsons?
10.3 points per game. Like we said, team high, 7.3 rebounds per. Actually leads the team with almost 4 assists per game.
Really?
Yeah. There you go, great passer.
And
what's Irv got?
Irv has... They don't break it down by per game, but he's at... Chandler Parsons is at 75 total, and Irv is at 69 total.
Huh.
So... Couple more there.
He's given assists to other teams also.
Right. Yeah, true.
And then Parsons is shooting 48%.
Got it.
38% from three.
That's not 40% is pretty, you know, almost
40% is very good.
Right, 48% is a very good field goal percentage. And honestly, like if you can get your small forward, like your third best 3-point shooter to shoot 38%, that you're in a pretty good situation.
Right. You look at those stats and you're like, why isn't Chandler Parsons getting more involved? But you kind of wonder if they said Chandler needs to take more shots, would his percentage be the same? Like, is it? I mean, he actively passes up open shots sometimes, but I feel like he's taking less shots. I think he's playing about as well as he can play.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think he's got. I mean, I think back to a game last year at Georgia where he dropped like 28, he may have had 10 rebounds and he had a bunch of assists. Well, like that could be Chandler. Not every game, but he could.
If you can get 28 points and 10 rebounds and 9 assists every game, but yeah, you're right.
Like the Rhode Island game, what was he there? Like 18, 12, and 6 or something like that?
I don't have the numbers, but he's a legitimate triple-double threat, or he could be.
Right, and he should be.
He said before the season, one of the exhibition games, he had like 9 points, 11 rebounds, and 8 assists or whatever, and people were like, did you know you were near a triple-double? What does that mean to you? And he was like, yeah, I'd like to get a couple of those this season because...
Like
he says, there's not a player in the country more versatile than he is, according to Chandler Parsons.
Chandler Parsons on Chandler Parsons.
So,
he also took a really nasty hit to the nuts, thanks to your best player.
The boys,
yeah.
Well, my best player wants to make sure he's better than your best player.
Here's another thing, though. Same thing that we...
say he's not physical enough.
This is a my dad stronger argument that we're having right now.
Same thing that we said with Macklin is Parsons only shoots 52% from the free throw line. Yeah. Actually airballed a couple this season.
That's his...
You showed negative percentage when you airball a free throw.
Right. That and his ability, his tendency to just, like, I said ability, his tendency to just disappear from games, like when he's not making shots, that to me is what keeps him from his potential. So, what you got, Greg?
Well, my pick for the best player on the team is Irvin Walker. So we will say...
because you see eye to eye with him?
Right. That's always a benefit.
Get it. Get it.
You guys got it.
Yeah.
I see what you did there. He's short, but he has a big heart. Also...
he is small, but he does play with a big, big Valentine, as the guy on ESPN said.
Anyway...
is that Jimmy Dykes?
No. It was the Georgia game. Okay. When he made like a layup. Like, look at that big Valentine.
Good Lord. Irving Walker. 14.4 points per game.
Leading the team?
Yes. Like we said, second in assists with 69. Somehow getting 3 rebounds per game. I don't know.
The big heart.
And then here's the one that sells it for me is he's leading the team with 45 3-point makes and he's shooting almost 40%. So on a team where outside shooting is streaky or non-existent, to have a guy like that who can hit at a decently consistent percentage, I think, is a big boost for them.
Well, 40% doesn't necessarily mean you're not streaky.
Right.
You could hit, like, 20 in a row and then miss, like, 15. Right, and still be hitting 40% or whatever.
He does have a tendency to be somewhat of a streaky player, but if you're making 40%, you're better streaky than other people who are poor streaky.
Well,
you're
correct.
Okay.
I mean, that's something.
It helps to get blocks. It helps to knock your
shots.
You
literally more. Just said... you said
making
that 40% 3-point shooting is better than like 30%. Right.
Well, that's my
shooting.
Point.
That's
okay, but I'm saying
you don't need to go into some sort of weird streaky versus
but
bad
you'd
streaky.
You'd argue over you'd argue for Irv over Chandler, who shoots roughly the same from three.
Here's the thing with Irv.
Gets more rebounds and gets more assists.
Yeah, but
Irv,
makes up for it by getting more turnovers.
That's true.
And by that, I mean turning the ball over more.
Right. Yeah, not steals.
Listen, he's only got 5 more turnovers on the season than Parsons.
Okay.
And he's been a lot better about it lately. Also.
Someone just got shot in the room.
This is a what have you done for me lately argument, or is it the best player argument?
No, it's just the best player argument.
Okay.
But, late in games, when the other team, when Florida's up by maybe 1 or 2, or they're down by a couple points, the other teams are pressing. Irv is the guy that's taking the ball up, beating the press, getting fouled, hitting the free throws.
Or missing the free throws.
And winning the game in clutch time.
Right.
And more often than not, hitting the free throws.
What's his free throw percentage just as a whole, though? Because it's got to be.
76%.
Yeah, which is what you want.
Which is, yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's a convincing argument for him. I'll give you that. And the fact that somehow he seems to have been designated the go-to guy in late-game situations.
Yeah, there's enough times where that hasn't gone well that I'm not really going to harp on that too much. But, like, shots like the one he hit against Georgia.
Right.
Just, you know, the ability to stay composed and be cool under pressure and do things like that are the difference between winning and losing a lot of the time.
Yeah, I remember 2 years ago when he was a freshman, it seemed like he was the only one willing to take shots.
He was ballsy then, too. Yeah.
Right, he's never been afraid to take shots.
Right, I mentioned on the video show he took the 35-foot turnaround bank three at Michigan State just to keep him alive in that game. And, I mean, that was essentially the difference in that one.
And then one of the things we talked about, or not we, I wasn't here, but we talked about last podcast was how Florida, sometimes it seems like they don't even have a half-court offense.
Right.
Like it kind of gets bogged down and nothing's really happening. Irv is the guy that can be a spark plug and make plays in that situation. Sometimes, like they talked about, he'll drive to the basket and he'll leave his feet and he'll turn it over or right. something. But a lot of the times he makes good plays in a situation like that, too, where otherwise they might have to just jack up a weak three at the end of the shot clock.
I'll say this for Irv. I like where his head's at with all that stuff. I like where his heart, I like where his Valentine's at with all that stuff. I like that he drives in and that he's trying to make plays. I think that's something Kenny Boynton should do more often, and he did against...
against Georgia against and a Georgia. Little bit against Mississippi State. Right. Not as much as against Georgia, but a little bit.
Whereas if Irv was, 4 inches taller, a little more athletic, I think the stuff he's doing would be a lot more effective, but it's just...
he'll get rejected. Who was it? Sydney got the block at the end when he had that layup attempt?
I think it was Augustus, yeah.
Augustus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Sydney can't run down the floor. That's good. Not going to happen.
Right.
He could just stay on defense. Right?
One guy I'm curious who didn't come up from any of us was Kenny Boynton, because I think he might be the most talented player on the team.
Yeah, but... a big part of basketball is being able to shoot, and he can't do that consistently.
Right.
Like that's the biggest difference with him. He's really not that big either. He's like 6'1".
Yeah.
That's what they're listing him at. but he can't really drive. And that's, I think, was his big thing in high school, was that he was able to drive and get layups and muscle his way to the hoop. Now it seems like he needs to pull up more.
I think he's very capable of driving, though, and he did that against Georgia. I don't think he's always going to drive and he's going to, you know, dunk on somebody or make layups.
Get to the rim and pass it or get contact. Yeah.
Because what did he do? What did he shoot it from?
12 free throws against Georgia.
Yeah. Which is incredible. Like, if you can get that from Kenny Boynton, good. Like, the fewer threes and the more free throws he shoots.
He's at 82% on the season.
Yeah.
Best on the team, so.
He has the potential and should be the best player of their team. I'll say that.
Okay. I'd agree.
I've liked his performances better since he started driving to the basket more. I think, I don't think he can't do it. I just think he hasn't. It's something he is good at, in my opinion.
And I think we'd probably all agree he's the best defender.
Yeah.
One-on-one on the team, so.
Right.
But yeah, I think Kenny's got probably the most potential, and he should be the best player. But clearly none of us agree on who is, but I think we can all at least agree on who should be.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to move on to our intro to sports journalism segment here, which once again has received very little feedback, but we're going to continue to do it because, as I always assume, no feedback is good feedback. We did actually get a reader request for a topic, though, and that is from Ed Spillane, our loyal listener out in College Station, Texas, who sent in an email that said, pull this up here. He said, you've already done some of this, but anything on the mechanics of actually putting together a story would be good. To what degree do you trust sources, and how does... He also asked how Twitter affects what we do, which we talked about last week, and about the availability of coaches and stuff like that. And it's funny because it's a misconception that I'm sure we've all dealt with at some point or another, is what we actually do, you know? So, you know what I mean? Like, some people,
it's very
just
broad,
right? Like, we've talked about it a little bit. Like, people assume, you know, you just ride with the team. You know, you fly with the team to games. You roll up. We talked about this at the beginning.
You guys aren't
of the
doing
season,
that.
So you're lying. But yeah, like, people have a very different concept of what we do in terms of post game and how everything works. So I'm going to turn this over to a trusted journalism veteran, Tyler Jett.
Where do you want? I don't understand exactly the question. Like, where do you want me to start with this?
Let's talk.
Talking about, like, writing a game story, or
let's talk game story.
Okay, well,
how much do you write during a game? Because people always see the reporters on press row typing away at their laptops, mostly on Twitter or Facebook.
I'm just on Facebook commenting on girls' photos.
Correct.
there you go. it just depends on the game, I guess. Like, if it's a football game that starts at 7 o'clock at night, you'll usually get an email from your editor, whichever paper you're working for, that will say, like, hey, we need your story in by 11:30 tonight. That's 4.5 hours after the game starts. Should be plenty of time. You watch the first half, you're taking... Usually what I'm doing with my computer is I'm taking notes of what's happening, and then I'll also go on, like, team websites and look at team stats and look how certain players have been doing for the season. Usually, like, away... Teams that Florida's playing, so I'm not as familiar with them, and, like, maybe a running back has 12 carries for 60-something yards. He's pretty successful against the Florida defense. Has, like, a touchdown or two, and I'm kind of looking, like, how has he been doing for the season? How does this compare? And if it's a lot more, then, okay, maybe I have a story there. So, really, I mean... The first half is all just organized confusion where you're just trying to figure out what your story is going to be.
Right.
Ideally, at halftime, you have at least 3 or 4 different ideas for different type of story that you can write on the game. And what's useful is that usually some media relations people will give you box scores after every quarter. And what I try to do is look at them. And the first thing you want to look at is the score. You obviously know the score, but you say, okay, Florida's down 14-7. Why are they losing the game? And you start looking at all the basic stats and see what are the differences. And that generally can give you an idea for the story. But you're really watching everything going on at the same time. You want to see what's happening on the field, first of all. Then you want to see what's happening on the sidelines. And then you want to be looking up stats during breaks. And you're watching a ton of things. You're never stopped looking at things. And I'd say probably midway through the third quarter, you kind of come up with, or I do, kind of figure out exactly what I want to write about. And then I'll start writing the story then. And then it can get really crazy if it's a tight game. I remember the LSU game this year. I had to write 2 stories. That was unfortunate. I honestly missed Florida's whole drive and they came back to win the game, or whatever, conceivably win the game. I only saw like 2 plays out of that drive because I was writing 2 stories. Like, if Florida wins the game, I had a story on like the comeback, or I can't remember exactly what the story was. They ended up losing the game. I didn't run that story. If they lost, it was basically how they couldn't stop the run against LSU. So I was writing both of those stories. Florida takes a touchdown. I'm like, sweet. I think it was a special teams and turnovers. That's what it was. It would have been special teams and turnovers because Florida got all their points pretty much from kick returns and turnovers. I think Andre DeBose returned to kick off for a touchdown.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that whole thing written. I'm like, oh, sweet. And then like I looked up and I had my whole Florida wins story written. Half of my Florida loses thing. I looked up for a second. Oh, LSU's going for a field goal to tie it. And there's a fake, and yep. I was like, oh, okay. So I saw the fake, and then I looked down, and I was like, crap, I got to start typing the LSU win story, so it looks like they might win. I looked up again, and I think it was Janoris Jenkins was getting dragged about 10 yards down, like, the 5-yard line by Tolliver. And I was like, oh, this really looks like Florida's going to lose. And then LSU obviously gets a touchdown with, like, whatever, less than 20 seconds left or whatever it was. So then I just frantically got my thing pretty much written. And then you obviously have to go down and talk to players, and that's where it really gets panicky, I would say, because you've got to, I mean, your deadline, let's say, is 11:30. The game is at 10:30. You go down. It's not like you just immediately get to talk to players. It's not like you even really at Florida. You don't really get to choose who you're going to talk to. There's no open locker room. You sit in, like, a room, and they bring players to you. Mm-hmm. So you sit there, and finally Urban comes out and talks, and someone asks a question about Les Miles, and he says, next question. And that goes on for a little bit. And then after Urban's little press conference for about 10 minutes, he leaves. Says, thank you, God bless, I love all of you so much. And then he walks out.
Hugs each one of you individually.
Hugs some of us, kisses others on the forehead, and then leaves and gives us words of advice, you young journalists out there. And then they'll bring in different players, and then if it's lost like that, you got to basically be like, hey, John Bostic, why were you terrible at stopping the run? And then usually, hopefully, they're pretty cool about it, and they'll talk to you about it. And then as soon as you get all the quotes you get, you just run back out of the press box real quick, and then finish up your story and send it in, hopefully before your deadline.
And these are the stories, the ones that you're talking about right there, that I think we all don't prefer. It's like when you have to just plug in quotes to what you've already written. I think we all, in a dream world, you know, we'd go down, we'd find out what they had to say, come back up and write sort of the consensus story of what happened down there and on the field, and be able to think about it and process it a little bit more and organize our thoughts. And a lot of times that's simply not the way it is. So like when people, you know, complain about writing or they wonder, why isn't this there? Why is this missing? Sometimes it's, and it sucks, but it's just strictly the situation we're in.
Right. And in games like that, you generally want, I mean, after the game's over and you've sent everything in, then you want to listen back to all the interviews that you have, and sometimes listen back to some interviews that your friends got. Like they may have talked to other players because there might be 10 players in the room at the same time. There's, you only have a certain amount of time. You got to talk to who you got to talk to for your story. And so you can listen to that stuff after the fact, and that kind of generates some ideas for the stories that will go on Monday through Friday, which are, to me, the way better stories, the stories that are really the ones that are worth reading, because most people watch the game, so they understand what's going on.
I agree.
But then those Monday through Friday stories are the more interesting ones.
Greg, you look eager to talk.
I mean, I think you guys about summed up the basic process of writing the game story. It's, for me, just the biggest things are just trying to, like, pay attention to every little thing, like, because for me, the thing I'm always most worried about, for whatever reason, is trying to generate the types of questions I want to ask after, because the things that they say really determine the stories that you write for the game and then through the week based on what's been going on with the team. So you have to just, like, look for little nuances and things that you can ask them about and actually sound like you know what you're talking about, rather than just people who are just like, so, what happened out there, you know? Like,
game's crazy, right?
A weird game, right? Huh. But I'm curious, we asked both of you this. What is the first thing you look to do when you sit down to write a story? Your lead, your first couple, you know, the thing that gets people into the story, or do you try to establish, like, some of the play-by-play and the context?
I think it's different for most people. For me, I'd say subconsciously, I've got the most important parts of the story, the meat of the story, like, in my head. Like, I know what I'm going to write. But when I sit down on the blank screen, I always want to start with the beginning of it. And I always try to come up with a lead, and you want to come up with something that's really, really creative first sentence to get someone into the story. And then after that, once I get the lead done, I can generally get the rest of the story pretty easily.
Right. Yeah, I'm pretty much the same way, because I have all the big points already, like, stored up in my head. I know what I want to write and how I want to get through all that. And then when I actually go to the writing portion, it's starting with the lead, which is usually the hardest part for me.
Right. I tend to agree with that. It's like, I think it was, not to go all journalistic whatever on it, but like Rick Bragg calls the stuff at the bottom boring but important. And then, like, the first, like, that to me is the easier part, you know? You can handle that. You know, it's what happened.
The boring but important part.
Right.
Yeah.
But then the hardest part is what you guys said, is getting people into the story.
Yeah, creating some sort of a narrative based on the story. For those that don't know, Rick Bragg won some Pulitzer Prizes writing features for the St. Petersburg Times, and now is, like, a journalism professor at the University of Alabama.
Right.
Some professors at UF who also worked at St. Peter are pretty close with him. That's how we know any of this.
Right, and we're all forced to read his stuff.
We're force-fed it.
Right, right, when we come in here at journalism
school. It's like vegetables.
But yeah, that's sort of the basic process. I think it's sort of an interesting, hope that answers your questions, Ed, and anybody else who is curious about the process of what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Hope we change your life.
All right, let's wrap up the show with our weekly awards, our Major Right Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport, and Wandy Pierre-Louis Bad Angles of the Week. Going to start with the majors. Go with Greg.
All right, I'm going to give mine to Jimmer Fredette.
Correct.
You guys may remember him as the guy who crapped on Florida when they lost lost to BYU in the first round of the NCAA tournament last year, scored 37 points. Last week, he scored 43 as BYU beat San Diego State in the best basketball game nobody knows happened.
No, everybody knows that happened. Did you go on Twitter?
Yeah, dude.
I went on Twitter, and I had to go down, 60 tweets to find something that wasn't Jimmer Fredette related. And I don't follow that many, sports writers on Twitter. I actually follow a lot of comedians. I follow a lot of, TV stars. I follow a prostitute on Twitter. So, there's not, I don't follow a lot of people that are necessarily the type of people are going to be talking about the basketball game. Mm-hmm. And everybody was still talking about it.
My problem is that it was on, CBS College Sports or some channel nobody gets.
People found it. No. People may not get it, but they found it.
They found it. They find the Jimmer.
He's great. He deserves really to be found.
He's magical. Yeah.
Certainly where they're.
He's the Steph Curry of 2011.
What's his points per game? Do you have that?
27.6.
Good lord.
Yeah, we need to start watching him all the time. It's kind of like when LeBron signed with the Heat. It's like, when this happens, this is going to be awesome. I need to watch every game. It's going to be so much fun to watch. Jimmer's the same way. You've got to watch everything Jimmer does.
Seems like he can get to the basket whenever he wants, and he shoots 43% from three. So
he's real good.
That's about
he's
it.
A real good.
Fine basketball player.
Tyler, major?
My major's going to go to the NHL All-Star Game in their format, which was just a lot of fun. It was basically they made Stahl and Lindstrom their captains and basically said, you guys pick teams, recess, which is cool because you always get the scene of, every, awesome NHL player all, lined up together and then picking players, which I think is just a lot of fun. And it's way more fun than, East versus West or North versus South, unless right. it's the Civil War. Or
which is a lot of fun.
Then it's a hoot and a holler. Yeah. But no, I just love the NHL. I like that format. I would kind of like to see every sport. I don't care East versus West in the NBA. I don't care about NFC versus AFC in football. I don't care about NL versus AL. I would like to see two awesome players pick teams.
Yeah, it was funny. The guy who got picked last won a car and got $30,000 or something like that.
For getting picked last?
Just like a giveaway.
Right. If you're Mr. Irrelevant, you get all this shit. I've been picked last in life in sporting events, man?
Yeah.
Cars and $30,000?
Yeah, they feel real bad for you.
Yeah.
It'd be cool if NBA All-Star Game was Team LeBron versus Team Kobe, sponsored by Vitamin Water,
That'd
and they got to pick players.
That would be a lot of fun. I'm going to give my major to Patrick Young, who, as we referenced earlier, solved the Florida basketball team's problems. At Monday Media, I forgot who it was, asked him a question about, what's been the most surprising thing about playing under Billy Donovan, which really, he could have done anything there. He could have said, how good of a coach Billy is.
It's really surprising because, Billy, he brushes his teeth right. three times a day.
Right, that's kind of weird, right? But he instead opted to say, it's how little energy the team occasionally comes out with, and the fact that you just never know whether or not the team can get itself mentally psyched up to go out and play under Billy Donovan, which he couldn't wrap his mind around.
Right.
You know?
He referenced that Billy Donovan has two national championship rings. You think you have a coach with two championship rings, you're just going to be pumped to play for him all the time. And right. a lot of people just don't come out with the energy that they should be coming out with.
And then when asked, why is that? Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. That's Florida basketball this year.
Well, what can you say?
Nothing. Nothing. So I'm not going to. What's your Wandy?
My Wandy goes to the state of Mississippi because it sucks.
Welcome aboard.
There you go. That's about it. There's nothing going on. There's four buildings.
It's not a very evolved state.
No.
It's just awful.
Arkansas is the worst state in the union, but that's a close second.
Yeah, they haven't really recovered from that Civil War.
Not yet. They're getting there though. That or the South will
rise close,
again.
They're close, man.
Luckily, I don't have a trip to Arkansas this year, but I'm ready.
Right. I'm going to give my Wandy to Coach Kevin O'Sullivan, who actually goes by Sully. So if you go on his Wikipedia page, you look him up, it says Kevin Sully O'Sullivan. So from here on out in the podcast, we refer to him as Sully O'Sullivan.
I like
him a lot. Real successful coach. Probably my favorite of the major coaches to talk to. He's real articulate. He's honest for the most part. And this is why I'm giving him my Wandy, is catcher Mike Zanino. Last year was a freshman. Entering the season, Sully last year was saying, our goal is to get to this point where the catchers are going to be calling all the game, every pitch. At least, we'll probably start 25-50%, and by the end of the year, every pitch. And, it was early in the year, Zanino may have been calling, 25-50%. It gradually went up, like was predicted. And then one week I asked Mike about this, I think in April, toward the end of the season, I said, so how much are you calling now? He goes, honestly, I'm not really calling much. Sully's calling everything from the dugout, which is actually fairly common in college baseball. And Sully was the catcher.
Right.
So, he understands this, and I mean, it's understandable, but then going into this season, someone asked Brian Johnson, the pitcher, about Zanino's development, and then I asked him something about calling games and if they expect to have him calling games more, or how is he at calling games, and he basically said, well, Sully calls pretty much, our coach calls pretty much everything. So clearly, Sully's calling this stuff, And so then I asked Sully, it's like, you know, last year you said that your goal was to have Zanino calling all the games by the end of the year. You started doing that, but by the end you kind of went away from that. Do you have that same goal again this year? He goes, oh, well, actually, Zanino's really good at calling games. I think he called pretty much every pitch last year. For whatever reason, you think that he's calling a lot less than he is.
You know, maybe because that's what people are telling you.
Yeah. And I couldn't, like, for whatever reason, like, I wish I was quick enough to say, well, Brian Johnson just said 10 minutes ago that you called every pitch. But I didn't think about it quick enough, or right. I think I was kind of taken aback by, like, this clearly isn't the truth. I didn't know what to do. Yeah. But I think it's a recruiting thing. Like, he's like, I used to be a catcher. I'll teach you everything about it. Like, talking to some young, wide-eyed high school catchers will say, you're going to know everything. You're going to be completely prepared for the MLB. You'll be calling games here. I'm a college catcher. No one's going to give you better instruction on how to call games than the University of Florida, which obviously isn't true. But I think he can't openly say that, or he's not going to openly say that. And so that's why. And I was a little bit sad because I thought, you know, I covered the team all last year. I liked him a lot. I felt like he was going to spit the truth to me, and he didn't really do that.
Wow, that's
heartbreaking,
yeah,
like, right?
That's rough. I'm going to give my Wandy wrapping it up here to the Pro Bowl because apparently it happened this weekend.
Not a big fan?
Really?
No. Yeah.
Huh.
Okay, if the Pro Bowl did like a Team A versus Team B, what would it be?
I'd watch.
Yeah, but who would it be?
Ooh, Peyton Manning and Tom Brady?
I guess. Yeah.
Right.
I want like Team Ray Lewis, and then
I want like Team Mike Vick versus Team Ray Lewis.
Right. Yeah, well, the thing with Mike Ray Lewis would be just all guys from the University of Miami, which would be fine with me. I think it'd be kind of fun.
That'd be so much fun. Right. Chang would be like, you know.
Yeah, and it would be cool. Was like it wasn't like guys that are voted into it. It's just everybody in the NFL. And you have like a fantasy draft,
right?
Like you do on Madden.
Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
Or
be
like you do in fantasy football.
That'd be a lot more fun than the Pro Bowl. I got home late last night from the office. I sat down at the TV, and my roommate Brett was watching NFL Network, and was like, huh. The Pro Bowl happened today, right? And I was like, yeah, I guess so. Like, did anybody care? Did any of you two watch it?
We watched a little bit in the office. Like, I turned it on. We were working in the office, and it was like 35-0 NFC. By the way, huge NFC fan, born and raised. Love the NFC. Real happy to see them get the big W.
I appreciate that they name the team. I just don't have to play the game, in my opinion.
Okay.
Like, I'm cool with, like, having a guy be able to say that he was selected to the Pro Bowl. But when you actually play the game, nobody cares. Like, even the players.
I agree.
Right. I'd love to watch a fantasy draft, though.
No, yeah, that'd be a ton of fun. I'd like to watch the actual fantasy draft itself.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I thought you meant the game result.
No, well, that too. But I would like to watch, like, yeah, they do a draft thing. They do it in the WWE all the time in wrestling.
I'd like to see the war room for those drafts, right. You know?
Ray Lewis in a suit.
That'd be great.
It'd be Ray Lewis and, like, Jerry Jones negotiating.
That'd be wonderful. Take that, NFL. Do that. That wraps up the show, though. Send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org. Get us up on Twitter at twitter.com/alligatorsports, at Adam D. Berry, at Jet Streamin.
No G.
No G. Greg, are you outing yourself yet?
Nope. When the time comes.
You
got to keep the people coming back.
Right, yeah, that's what they're coming back for.
Right.
You can also find us on twitter.com or facebook.com/alligatorpodcast. You can watch our video show on there. I display my wonderful basketball skills. Completely make it rain from the outside at the end.
Greg displays his awesome acting skills.
Once again.
Yeah, dude. We're getting better.
Yeah. The video itself actually is a lot better this week. I'd recommend watching it, if only for the women's basketball and gymnastics stuff. Sorry, Greg and me. Right. Yeah.
It's fair. You're welcome, perverts.
Right.
And on that note.
Thanks
for listening.
We're out.